Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We begin this hour with a look at Astronomy Day at the University of South Dakota. We're broadcasting live today from our studios in Vermilion. With me in the studio, we have Joel Sander. He is an assistant physics professor at the University of South Dakota. Joel, thanks for being here.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Vuk Mandich. He's associate professor in the School of Physics and Astronomy at the University of South Dakota. Dr. Mandich, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you are here in town for Astronomy Day, but we're going to start with Joel and sort of talk about the background and the history of this day at USD.
Yes. So Astronomy Day is an international event to try to talk about astronomy and bring exposure to that to the world. We at USD try to celebrate it, but rather than trying to celebrate just on the International Astronomy Day, we try to tune it to the academic calendar. And so we've been doing this since 2002.
All right. So some of your guests in the past have been pretty exciting.
Yeah. So 2002 was pretty exciting. We had Harrison Schmidt, who was a geologist. So we did this, invited him in jointly with the geology department. He was an astronaut who has the additional claim to fame of being the second to last person to walk on the moon.
Yeah.
So I maybe lost the coin flip between which one was the last one to step in.
As long as you're somebody who walked on the moon, it's okay. It doesn't really matter what order anymore,
exactly.
Does it? Maybe between them. They have a little bragging rights between them.
Hey, I'm impressed either way.
That's right.
We've had Leon Lederman, who won the 1988 Nobel Prize in Physics. We actually were trying to get him for the first time, but he had a Nobel Centennial Ceremony that took precedence.
All right. So, also allowed.
Yeah, it's a good excuse.
Okay, so what do you sort of hope, who do you hope comes to the events what are you trying to accomplish with the conversations?
So that's a great question. We're trying to really reach out to the community, to South Dakota, and to bring astronomy, some of the big impactful things in astronomy, to the broader community, to the students in South Dakota. All right, and so we have our capstone is an Astronomy Day talk. It's set usually in the evening that really is designed to bring in a speaker who gives a talk to really reach out.
Right. So that is where you come in, Vuk Mandich. And that talk is, by the way, tonight at 7 p.m. in Patterson at 117. That's open to the public. Is it free, Joel?
It is free.
It is free, so you can come in. Give me an idea what you're going to start with tonight at that talk for the general public.
So I will talk about the recent discovery of gravitational waves.
Yeah.
This was in the news about a year ago, nationally and internationally. And basically what it is about a year ago, in February 2016, to be more precise, LIGO collaboration announced the detection of the first gravitational wave signal that was generated by a merger or collision of two black holes about 1.3 billion light years away. So
let's go back to that time a little bit. First, for people who are just tuning in, what's LIGO?
LIGO stands for the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. Mm-hmm. It is a new type of a detector that is designed to look for these very small perturbations in space-time.
All right. So we knew they were there. We had a theory they were there. We had a theory they could be measured.
That's right. Einstein predicted them just about 100 years ago. To the dot.
How? What was his thought process? Tell me what Einstein was thinking.
So that's not an easy one.
Right?
But his idea, what Einstein gave us, was this connection between mass or energy on one side and space and time on the other. Okay. So in a sense that if you have mass or energy in some region of space, then that region of space is curved. And that is basically how we think about gravity today. For example, the sun is very massive, and its mass warps the space-time around it. Okay. So that the paths of shortest distances would not be straight lines anymore. They would be curved paths. In fact, they would be circles, and that's why the Earth goes in a circle around the sun.
All right.
So what he proposed this theory, which is the general theory of relativity, in 2015. And in 2016, he realized that in a specific situation where the masses or energies are relatively small, his theory reduces to a simple wave equation, the same kind of equation that would describe waves on the surface of a pond, for example, or sound waves in air. And the solutions to that equation are waves in space-time itself. They're ripples in space-time that propagate outwards from the source, just like waves propagate outwards from when you drop a stone in the water, for example.
Sure.
Same idea. So it's just a different characteristic or different nature of the waves.
Did he think that they would ever be measured, that theory would ever, that we would get to this point that we're at today?
So that's an excellent question. I think in his time, he and his contemporaries probably thought that it would never be measured. But there were two things that changed since his time. One is that we now have much better technology that was not really accessible at the time. And second, we have these compact, very massive objects, things like black holes and neutron stars, that did not, the existence of which was not known at the Einstein's time. And you really need to have very massive things moving very fast, close to the speed of light, in order to generate gravitational waves that are detectable.
All right. So this the discovery was sort of made public almost a year ago. What was that moment like? Because that's a big deal.
That was a big deal. Yes, that was really exciting for all of us in the
field. Did you know it was going to be announced? Were you on the inside of this?
Yes.
So you had to keep the information sort of secret, the work that you were doing.
For about 6 months, yes.
6 months. How was that?
That was very hard.
To contain your excitement?
You just want to tell everybody, but one of the, you know, it's for discoveries of this kind of magnitude, you have to be very sure that there is no some mistake in the analysis, for example, or that some other environmental effect may have caused this kind of signals in our detectors. So we spent a lot of time, 6 months basically, the entire collaboration, we count about 1,000 people,
wow,
had to really pour through the data and make sure that we understand the signal, that it's a real signal, and to understand the system, that this binary black hole system that generated the signal.
Help me understand, do I hear the signal? Do I see it? What is it? How do I know there's a signal on the technology that we're talking about?
So the signal itself is, as I mentioned, it's a perturbation in space-time. It changes the distances between objects in space. So if you imagine a ring of masses just floating in space, nothing is acting on it. As a gravitational wave passes through it, that circle of masses or ring could be stretched into an ellipse in one direction, and then a little bit later it will be an ellipse in the perpendicular direction, and so on.
Okay.
That squeezing and stretching of space is what we measure. Now, the frequency, how many cycles per second of these waves you get, is of the order of a 100 cycles per second, or maybe 1,000, so on that scale. And those are the frequencies that we can hear in sound waves. So if we take this signal recorded by the LIGO detectors and just simply put it into a speaker, it would produce a sound that we can actually hear with our own ears.
Okay.
So in a sense, we can hear them, but what we are hearing is really kind of a translation of the gravitation wave into a sound effect.
All right. So you are excellent at explaining this, too. I mean, I can't imagine what the technical talk is. It would be completely over a lot of our heads. But I want to talk about how important it is to be able to make that translation to people who aren't in the scientific community. And maybe, Joel, you want to talk a little bit about that with students and then with the general public. How good do you have to be as a scientist to translate what you're doing in your lab, in your mind, and with each other, and then with the rest of us?
It's a skill that takes practice like any other. And you have to really understand what it is you're doing. Otherwise, you can't translate it down. But then you have, or inside down, but you also have to really understand what is the really big core idea. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, I think in physics, the core idea is itself not terribly complicated, but all the different technology pieces and things we have to do to try to get to it, like the technology Vuk was telling us about, gets to be quite a lot.
Right.
But the real key physics idea, you know, that space and masses can warp space and change it, is in itself not a terribly complicated idea. I mean, we're all used to throwing rocks in ponds and seeing the surface change.
Right.
It's just that space itself is doing that.
So what happens next then after, you know, the research is made public and people are, go through their period of skepticism, I'm guessing, and challenging you with everything that you've done for the past 6 months? What's the, you know, what's the benefit?
So the very first consequence of this is that we now know, well, this was basically the first direct evidence that black holes exist.
Okay.
And black holes, of course, are black, so you cannot directly see them using traditional telescopes, which measure light. So this was the first direct evidence that black holes exist. Not only that, they live in binaries or can live in binaries.
What does that mean?
A binary means that two black holes are gravitationally connected to each other, so they just keep spinning around each other.
Okay.
They form a system together. And they can live dynamic lives. They can eventually merge and create these huge explosions, which you don't see in light at all. These are enormous energy bursts that really just happen to be in gravitational waves. So you can measure them with these specialized detectors, but not with telescopes. So what I'm getting at is there's an entire, it seems like there's an entire class of events in the universe that we just couldn't see until now. Hmm. And so we tend to say we're opening a new window onto the universe. We're beginning to do astronomy or astrophysics using gravitational waves. And we don't know what we'll find. We know we have expectations that there will be other binary black holes, or there will be neutron stars, which is similar, somewhat lighter, but still compact objects and very heavy objects. We expect to maybe see some signatures from the Big Bang itself, which is also expected to produce gravitational waves. Mm. But there will probably be many things that we are not anticipating at the moment.
How is that possible, to see a signature of the Big Bang itself?
That's an excellent question. And that one, I can't really give you a good intuitive answer. Mm. The way we imagine the Big Bang at the moment is that it's a very energetic event, but also chaotic. And this chaoticness, if that's a word, creates mass perturbations, mass variations from place to place, which move very fast and therefore produce gravitational waves. So these signals can then get amplified as the universe expanded and went through different transitions in its evolution history. So today we may be able to see those. And if we could, we could basically look at how the universe behaved a fraction of a second after this explosion, which we can't do in a lab.
Yeah.
We cannot reproduce that kinds of energies in a laboratory setting.
Yeah.
So it's an exciting
Yeah, I was going to say, you just get excited about your jobs, because that's
absolutely
really cool.
it is exciting. And I'll leapfrog on to what Vuk said here, and that is, it's not unprecedented to see first things from the early light of the universe. For example, we see the cosmic microwave background light, right? The very mm-hmm. earliest light from the Big Bang. And so we're able to see that, but that's totally different than being able to see the early vibration and shaking of the universe, you know, kind of how it shook, rattled, and rolled to start the universe.
It must be a thrill to sort of bring students or younger scientists into and sort of watch that light bulb go on for them. And I'm wondering, when you first knew that you wanted to study this, and because it must take up an inordinate amount of mental space as well as your time, you'd have to love doing it. When did you decide that this is what you wanted to do?
So for me, a lot of it came as I was a graduate student and started working in the lab. And I started connecting what I was doing day to day, getting to play with very interesting tools and work with that type of thing. And with the ideas that we can see something new that nobody else has ever seen. I mean, there's something brand new under the sun, and you know, it's the kind of thing that's not easy to define. And so it takes teams of people, and I like working with people. And so suddenly it just brought together all the things that I thought were interesting towards a really interesting end. And
yeah. Vuk?
So for me, I always knew I wanted to do science. I was always interested in it. But I think it was when I started college and when I started trying out different things that my direction crystallized towards physics. And then after that, it really is a function of what you get exposed to. And I was in a situation that I got exposed to astrophysics or cosmology relatively early, and I fell in love with it, and I stuck with it. So that's step by step led to here.
What are you hoping to see next, to learn next, to discover next as you look into that window in the universe?
So my primary interest in this field is detecting exactly those early universe signals. Those are very hard to see. They're expected to be very small, but we don't know. Mm. And detecting them would give us a whole new light, if you like, on how the universe started.
What are you doing to make that happen? Is that something that happens in your lifetime? Is it something that could happen tomorrow?
Tomorrow might be a little bit pushing it, okay. but something on the order of 10, 15, 20 years, I think it's plausible. We don't know what the universe did then, so it may really happen that we discover it over the next few years with the existing gravitational wave detectors. But if not, the community is already trying to figure out how to build the next generation, more sensitive detectors and so on. Mm. That may have that capability.
How is funding? Are you well supported in this the area? Do you need more support?
More support would always be good. I think, especially now with the discovery, we're expecting the community to grow. There should be more scientists joining the field and really fully exploring this the scientific potential of this field. Yeah. So we definitely would like to see the funding. Funding agencies keep up with that kind of inflow and continue to support.
Collaborative
us.
Or competitive?
Collaborative is more important, I think, than competitive, at least in this field, because the complexity of it of the problem is very high, and you need large numbers of people to address the many problems that we're facing.
Right. This is Astronomy Day lecture is tonight at 7 p.m. open to the public in Patterson 117. The technical lecture is at 1:30 in
Slagle 312.
Slagle 312. So if you want to get to the nuts and bolts and you understand all the ins and outs, that's where you show up. 7 o'clock for everyone else. Dr. Vuk Mandich, thank you so much for being here. It's been a pleasure meeting you. Good luck with everything. We'll keep keep our eyes open for the next big discovery.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank
and
you.
Joel with the University of South Dakota, thanks so much for being here as well.
My pleasure.